Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Haitian rebels continue to advance toward the country's capital, Port-au-Prince, as the foreign minister of France called for Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide's resignation, and U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell raised questions about Aristide's continued viability, though stopping just short of calling for him to step down. We're joined now from Port-au-Prince by Kathy Klarich, who's reporting for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Kathy.
Thanks very much.
Kathy, thanks for joining us. What's the state of the Capitol?
There's pretty widespread looting. Tires are burning. Gas stations have closed, so there's a real concern about a gas shortage. And I think general instability. I know that there have been roadblocks that have been put up for the last couple of days. People are concerned about driving around because they have been robbed and their cars have been stolen.
Now, the rebels are not in Port-au-Prince yet, right? So who's doing the looting?
The looting is being done allegedly by these groups called the Chimère, which are armed thugs supposedly linked to Aristide, and their purpose is to make sure that the city is under their control in case the rebels do come in.
Where are the rebels, so much as you can tell?
Well, I was up in Cape Haitien just yesterday morning, actually, and they were still there. Cape Haitien is about a five-hour drive, so I do think that they have quite a few what they would call cells that are just waiting for the right opportunity that are already in Port-au-Prince, but the actual leaders, the armed rebel leaders, are still up in Cape Haitien, or they were as of yesterday.
What is the mood of the rebels? What are they telling you? Are they optimistic? They're convinced they're going to be able to take the capital?
They're pretty cocky. They're staying up in a really nice hotel that overlooks the water. They hang out by the pool with their weapons and their drinks, and they're convinced that they're going to be able to basically walk into the Capitol. They're a little bit concerned about armed resistance around the palace, where Aristide has about 1,800 men in his own security force. But they think that once they come in, everybody will roll over and disappear.
And what are they waiting for?
It's unclear. What they said was they were waiting for their intelligence to come back so that they were very clear about where the armed resistance pockets were.
Now, Haiti's third largest city, Lacaille, fell yesterday, Kathy. When we say that a city like Lacaille falls to the rebels, is there fighting in the streets or do they just walk in and take it over?
Well, it's unclear exactly what happened in Lacaille. It does not sound as though the group that took over Okai is actually part of the group, the rebel group in the north. What it sounds more like is people who are anti-Aristide have kicked out the government, basically the police force and the government representatives. So I think that there were certainly some skirmishes. I don't have any figures on whether or not people were killed. But the point would be to get rid of the government representatives.
Now, President Aristide continues to say he won't resign. What's the sense in the Capitol? Will he inevitably have to resign or will he go down fighting?
It's very hard to say, but when you look around at the possibilities of him being able to govern, it seems quite unlikely that with his demise and popularity and the absolute chaos and anarchy in the streets that he would be able to remain. Now, that being said, you know, if an international peace force came in while he was still here, then they would basically have to defend his presidency. So unless an international force comes in, quite honestly, I don't see how he can stay.
How are average people coping, getting food, concerns about hospitals? Obviously, children aren't going to school, I assume.
It's extremely disrupted and upsetting. Certainly schools have closed, businesses have closed. The fact that you can't get gasoline, you know, automatically cuts off traveling in and around the capital. I think people are extremely concerned and extremely on edge because there's really a sense of lawlessness that's taken over the capital.
And is there a sense that when the rebels come in that lawlessness will end, or is there fear the anarchy could continue, particularly as we start to get a sense that, as you said, there are these different cells of rebels, not necessarily under the command of just one or two or three people?
Quite honestly, I think if there is resistance, that it could get very ugly very quickly because there is no real security force that can keep it under control. I think people are extremely concerned that this could be a very bloody battle, and they're hoping that there will be some movement within the next couple of days that will avoid this.
Kathy Klarich joined us from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Kathy, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Kathy reports for the Christian Science Monitor.
The U.S. Congressional Black Caucus is calling on President Bush to do more about stabilizing the uprising in Haiti, reportedly asking for up to 400 U.S. troops. We're joined now by a caucus member, Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson, Democrat from Texas. Congresswoman Johnson, some would say the U.S. can ill afford to send more troops into a conflict. Why do you think the U.S. should send forces?
Well, we haven't said the U.S. should, but we have said the U.S. should support them as we go to the U.N. to involve the U.N. But I do think that we have the power and the right to request that the U.N. and other nations support our standing in doing so.
Well, as you know, the French are speaking directly to Haitian leaders. They've proposed sending an international force, but it comes with a sort of a quid pro quo. The French foreign minister says that Aristide must first resign and make way for a transitional power-sharing government. What do you think of that?
We feel strongly that he was democratically elected and don't feel that we have the right to demand that he step out of that office. What the circumstances will call for at this time, I guess, will have to be considered by him as well as some of the other leaders in place at this time.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson, who is currently visiting Libya, says that unless something happens immediately, President Aristide could be killed and that we can't allow that to happen to a democracy. Do you also fear for Aristide's life, or is it more for Haiti?
That's one of the reasons why we went to the president. We do fear for his life based upon what has been said. And I'm assuming that he fears for his own life.
Well, when you met with President Bush and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and Secretary of State Colin Powell this week, what did you ask the president about Haiti?
We asked him to make his leadership known, to express and show some caring about the people of Haiti. We have pointed out how close Haiti was situated to this country and how we should not sit back and allow the kind of killing and murder and the withholding of food or whatever might be going on at this time.
And what was the president's reaction?
The president indicated that he stood in the same place. He was equally as interested in the outcome of what was happening to the people and that he would give it his utmost attention.
Well, Congresswoman, yesterday the Coast Guard said it had intercepted 546 Haitians in the past 3 to 4 days trying to make their way to the Florida coast. Now, during the 90s, when there was also tumult, we know there were 2,000 or 3,000 Haitians a day coming to Florida. The Bush administration has said that all Haitians trying to come to the states as asylum seekers would be turned back. Do you agree with that?
No, I do not agree with that, but we have been talking about that for the last 5 or 6 years or more. We have asked repeatedly why it was a different policy between Haiti and Cuba. And their response has been is that Haiti is democracy, that Cuba is a communist country, and that our policy is to give relief to those who are in oppressive governments.
Well, as you and the members of the caucus point out, it's a democracy that's very much endangered.
We have pointed that out for the last 6 to 8 years that I'm aware of.
Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson, thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Congresswoman Johnson, a Democrat from Texas, is also a member of the Congressional Black Caucus.
There are revelations today of another hunting trip involving Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. The incident dates to November 2001, when Scalia was a guest of the University of Kansas Law School. At that time, the justice went hunting with the governor of Kansas and the school's dean. The dean was also the lead attorney for the state of Kansas in two active Supreme Court cases. Justice Scalia has issued a statement saying he doesn't believe the circumstances could reasonably lead anyone to question his impartiality. This incident is being compared with Scalia's more recent hunting trip with Vice President Dick Cheney at a time when Cheney is a litigant before the court. Well, Cynthia Gray is the director of the Center for Judicial Ethics at the American Judicature Society. Cynthia, welcome.
Thank you.
Cynthia, Justice Scalia says his impartiality couldn't reasonably be questioned over this. What do you think?
Well, I think that his actions do raise questions about how sensitive he is to ethical issues.
What is the law on all this?
There's a provision in the U.S. Code that requires justices of the Supreme Court to disqualify themselves when their impartiality might reasonably be questioned. In some circumstances, there are very straightforward rules. You know, if a judge owns stock in a party, if one of their family members is a party in the case, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of situations that it's hard to draw hard and fast rules.
And who draws the rules is the judge, him or herself, right? It's up to them to decide whether they can be impartial in a given situation.
In the Supreme Court justice's case, yes, it is their decision.
So what troubles you about this? The dean of the law school was to appear before the Supreme Court as a lawyer. That's different, of course, than the Cheney case, in which the vice president is himself a litigant, having to do with meetings he had concerning energy policy early in the Bush administration.
Right, there isn't really any difference between attorneys and parties in the case. I mean, your impartiality might reasonably be questioned because of your relationship with an attorney as well as your relationship with a party.
Now, I guess the idea would be that Justice Scalia, although a Supreme Court justice, seeing an attorney before him who he knows personally or seeing a vice president he's gone duck hunting with says, well, for example, in the case of Cheney, well, Dick's a good guy. I'll cut him some slack. Is that what you're suggesting might happen here?
Well, the question is whether the public would have reason to believe that's the case,
mm-hmm.
Whether the public would question the impartiality of a judge's decision in the case when the judge has recently socialized with that person and apparently has a close relationship with that person. It's important that the public have confidence that decisions are being reached impartially. And to have that trust, judges need to act in a certain way.
And in fact, in these two cases concerning Kansas, the judge ruled in Kansas's favor, ruled in favor of the dean of the Kansas Law School who had appeared before him as an attorney. And that can cast a shadow on the decision you're suggesting.
Right.
Now, Scalia points out that if he's unable to meet, for example, governors because their state might appear before the Supreme Court, well, that would unreasonably restrict his access to people that he would normally meet.
Well, the argument is not that he couldn't go, you know, to some sort of public dinner with them, but a hunting trip is a very private, cozy situation, and it's a sort of access to the justice that most people would not have.
Do you believe that Justice Scalia should recuse himself from the case involving the vice president?
Yes, I do. I think his impartiality has been questioned and is a reasonable question, and he definitely shouldn't have gone hunting with him.
Cynthia Gray is the director of the Center for Judicial Ethics at the American Judicature Society. Cynthia, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the rise of blatant anti-Semitism in France.
And later in our show, our review of the new film, The Passion of the Christ.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's not just the synagogue bombings or the desecrated Jewish headstones or even attacks on Jewish schools and homes. It's the other undercurrents of anti-Semitism, the taunts on Jewish school children, the heckling of a Jewish singer as she performed, the use of epithets in mainstream language that are changing the face of France's Jewish community. That's the portrait painted by writer Fernanda Eberstadt in an article titled A Frenchman or a Jew, which will appear in this Sunday's New York Times magazine. Fernanda joins us from her home in Perpignan, France. Welcome.
Thank you.
You paint a pretty disturbing picture of this widespread anti-Semitism to the extent that there's the liberal use of an epithet. Can you tell us about that word?
Oh, there's a word called fuge. It's a kind of street slang where you reverse syllables, reverse letters. So fuge is juif, which is the French word for Jew.
How are kids in school in particular using it?
They're using fuge, i.e. Jew, as an insult. Oh, this pen doesn't work. It's so fuge. Don't eat by yourself like a fuge. People, you know, kids sort of say openly they're anti-fuge. There's a kind of rise in all kinds of ethnic, racial insults kind of all around.
And you write, in fact, it's the worst epidemic of anti-Jewish violence since the end of the Second World War, much of it at the hands of young Muslims. And you write later, a newly imported Wahhabi style of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I think in the according to one person I talked to after the end of the Iranian Revolution, there was an import of more fundamentalist imams into France, and who started spreading anti-Semitism along with a much more virulent fundamentalist brand of Islam.
You're careful to point out, of course, you know, that means it's not all Muslims. But why is this happening?
Well, this recent outbreak started in October 2000, and its rises and falls have very much followed events in the Middle East.
And as you write, many put the blame on the heavy-handed politics of the Sharon government, but also some place the blame on the left.
A lot of former French leftists say that the French left has been too acquiescent, that it's used to taking up the cause of young Muslim teenagers who are unemployed, disadvantaged, and that it's found it hard to criticize this new batch of anti-Semitism. It's easier to come out against anti-Semitism when it's coming from the extreme right, from the French National Front.
Mm-hmm. There is a perception here as well, we've heard, of people who support the Palestinian cause unable to criticize any actions of the Palestinian cause, suicide bombing, for instance, and sort of painting themselves in that corner.
Yeah, there's a polarization on both sides. For instance, French Jews find themselves kind of paralyzed, unable or unwilling to criticize Israel or criticize Sharon's policies. Mm. And the same things happen on the left. Both sides are increasingly polarized and alienated and sort of locked into their own constituents' policies.
Which you write opens up the door for good old-fashioned anti-Semites to, as you write, clothe a disreputable hatred in the raiments of the Palestinian cause.
Yeah, there's been a strange alliance in France between, for instance, the traditional far right and certain Islamist clerics, Islamist activists who have sort of made this peculiar sort of bargain.
Well, the story you write is uniquely French because of the way the French see themselves as French first and then their faith second. And, I mean, the point of your story is that that's changing.
Yeah, that's the big thing that's happening here. The ethic of integration was very, very strong here in France, and now that's giving way to identity politics. Young French North African kids, second-generation immigrants, are becoming much more Muslim, much more ethnically identified, and it's been happening over the last 20 years for Jews, too. People aren't French first anymore. Jewish pride, Jewish identity, as a kind of defensive mechanism.
Well, the Chirac government, as you write, is cracking down on anti-Semitic incidents.
The government has been fantastic in cracking down on anti-Semitism.
And then, of course, there's the headscarf debate, the barring of any kind of religious ornament, including headscarves. Can you relate that to this story?
Yes. That's the most explosive thing that's happening in France now, is the new law against ostentatious religious symbols in schools. You know, Muslims see that as persecution, especially aimed at them, which it is. A lot of French people are relieved that it's a kind of toning down, a kind of calming of this rising ethnic strife. It's Chirac's attempt to sort of revive this dying idea of the French state, of French secularism, and most French people are incredibly relieved that this sort of idea of integration and a kind of neutral public space is being reasserted.
Yeah. But will it work?
We'll see. There's a lot of forces against it. I think most people think it's too late. That sort of identity politics has arrived in France, and that the days of the French Republican ideal are finished. Mm-hmm. It's a last attempt, but it's a valiant ideal, and it should be fought for. You know, there's maybe 600,000 Jews and 6 million Muslims
in France.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of immigration from former colonies.
So much of this is uniquely French because of its former colonies, because of its demand for secularism. But how is this affecting the rest of Europe?
It's a wave that swept across the whole of Europe. Governments have been very reluctant to speak out against the kind of violence that's coming from Muslim immigrants and second generation immigrants, because it's a population that's experienced so much racism and so much discrimination itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, Fernando, thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
It's a fascinating article, and people can read it in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Author Fernanda Eberstadt spoke to us from her home in southern France. Her article in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine is entitled A Frenchman or a Jew.
Next week on Here and Now, as Super Tuesday nears, we'll look at the Democratic primaries in some of the key states.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Since 1950, at least 4% of Catholic priests in the United States sexually abused children. More than 10,000 minors, mostly boys, molested. In the peak year of 1970, one in every 10 priests in this country would be eventually accused of abuse. That's the conclusion of two reports commissioned by U.S. bishops and released today. National Review board member Bob Bennett said that church officials simply did not screen priest candidates properly. Seminaries lost their way in preparing them for the priesthood. But bishops were ultimately to blame.
Some bishops placed the interests of the accused priests above those of the victims, and too often declined to hear from victims directly, saying, well, Father must be right. I've got to take Father's word.
The head of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, Wilton Gregory, responded, saying that church leaders failed to act.
What might have appeared to be, over the decades, a limited problem in individual dioceses or religious orders gave rise to the sobering picture we are now confronting.
Joining us in the studio is WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyerov, who's covered the story from the beginning. Monica, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Is this an accurate, definitive account of abuse cases?
Well, the survey was conducted by the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, an independent body, and 97% of the response rate came from the diocese. So they say that they've got a good response rate, but it was self-reported by the bishops and done anonymously. This has been criticized by many, but the lead investigator said because of this confidentiality, they got the result of 4% of priest abusers, which is higher than publicly reported before, but it is really impossible to say whether it's accurate.
Do the reports name any individuals or blame specific church policies?
No, there are no names named, no priests accused of abuse or bishops who assign them, not even by diocese broken down. But the report does blame generally the seminary, saying that they didn't screen properly and many dysfunctional and psychosexual men became priests. Also, the seminarians were not prepared for the challenges of practicing priesthood in what they said was an over-sexualized society, and they didn't lead chaste and celibate lives. But most importantly, they placed the blame squarely on the shoulders of bishops, saying that the bishops didn't understand the nature of the problem, they were scared of litigation, and they disregarded their pastoral role. They didn't communicate with each other. Here's Bob Bennett of the National Review Board.
Some bishops simply did not give the issue very high priority. As one bishop told us, cardinal law, he wasn't even paying attention to the problem. And cardinal law was not alone.
Monica, do the reports reach any conclusions on major themes in all this, like homosexuality in the priesthood or the effect of celibacy on the scandal?
It did touch on those themes. It said that celibacy is not the cause of the problem, but the celibacy requirement may have attracted candidates to the priesthood who were wanting to escape from their sexual problems. And it also said it has to note that while it didn't have any conclusion about gay priests, more than 80% of the abuse was of a homosexual nature. So they didn't draw any conclusions from that, but they did mention it, which is significant.
What about victims? Are they speaking out, reacting to this yet?
Victims are reacting. They're reacting strongly, and they're saying these numbers are too low. They believe thousands of victims haven't reported the abuse, and dozens of bishops aren't telling what they know, and we won't know that for sure because this has been self-reported. So they note that while the bishops are saying this has been reduced since the 1980s and the problems, the victims are saying there are thousands more who could come forward because it can take years to confront your abuse.
Well, what does happen next? Do these reports or Bishop Gregory say what should be done with offending clerics?
He didn't say specifically. Bishop Gregory said that those who failed in their responsibility are first responsible to their people and then obviously to the Vatican, but every case must be examined individually. And that those he noted that the cases that involve some bad decisions do go back 20 to 30 years, so many of these people aren't in service any longer, and he was pleased with that.
WBUR reporter Monica Brady Myroff.
Meanwhile, the first American Catholic bishop may face criminal charges as a result of child abuse accusations and is being investigated in the Massachusetts city of Springfield. Thomas Dupree retired 2 weeks ago after a newspaper reporter confronted him with allegations of sexual abuse. Joining us in the studio is WBUR reporter Fred Tice. And Fred, these are new allegations. Tell us what the allegations are and why did they surface now?
Well, the allegations are that Bishop Dupree essentially raped these two boys from the time that one of them was 12 until one was 17 and the other one was 20 years old, had sex with them throughout all that time over a long period of time. One boy was an immigrant whom he taught English, and then the other one was a friend of his that the boy brought along a couple of years into their relationship. This was repeated abuse. He told one of the boys he was in love with him. He took them to New Hampshire, to New York on weekend trips where abuse also occurred, an extensive pattern of abuse.
But these allegations began years ago, so why are they surfacing now?
Well, what happened was that one of the boys, who is gay, moved out to San Francisco and was apparently infuriated with the fact that Bishop Dupree was out in the press being very vocal against the issue of same-sex marriage, which obviously is huge here in Massachusetts right now. And he contacted Eric McLeish, who is an attorney who has represented hundreds of victims in the Diocese of Fall River and Boston, victims of sexual abuse by priests.
Mm. Is there a criminal investigation going on?
There is. The district attorney for Hampden County, the county around Springfield, is investigating and looking into these allegations right now.
And how might the statute of limitations apply?
It will apply with regard to the sexual abuse itself. Massachusetts has very strict rules on when you can bring these charges, and it appears that all the sexual abuse occurred too long ago. However, the bishop allegedly maintained contact with these two men until recently, and there may be grounds for charging the bishop with obstruction of justice, trying to keep them quiet. And in New Hampshire and in New York, there are no such statutes of limitations, or there are statutes of limitations, they're not as strict as they are here in Massachusetts. So he may actually be indicted in those states for the actual abuse.
How significant is this, Fred, that this is the first bishop charged?
I guess at some point you have to figure that somebody was going to be charged because there are just so many priests who have been accused. And, of course, priests move up the ladder. And there are these allegations that they protected one another and that the hierarchy protected priests who were abusive. And so I suppose it should come as no surprise, but it's still quite a shock to the people of Springfield who all along have been asking for investigations into alleged abuse by priests and then find that the man they'd been talking to all these years is now himself charged with abusing these two boys.
And, of course, is in a position of much more power than, for instance, a priest.
And controls the records, which have disappeared in Springfield, apparently. Many of the records apparently have disappeared.
Huh. Well, where is Bishop Dupree?
He is in treatment at a place called St. Luke's. It's in Maryland. It's a place where priests go for treatment for, among other things, pedophilia.
Fred Tice, thank you.
You're welcome.
WBUR reporter Fred Tice.
Still to come, The Passion of the Christ, from historical and critical perspectives.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The chairman of the board of the Smith & Wesson Holding Corporation, parent company of the famous gunmaker, resigned yesterday after it was revealed that he had been an armed robber. James Minder had been elected to the board's chair in January. None of the other board members knew of his crime spree and arrest in the 1950s. Minder served 15 years in prison. Jonathan Higuera, reporter for the Arizona Republic, has been following the story. He joins us on the line. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello.
Jonathan, Smith & Wesson bills itself as a partner to law enforcement. Is the company a bit embarrassed about having a lawbreaker at the top of the company?
Well, I got to believe they are, but I've got to be honest, they haven't returned my calls on this story.
Well, tell us a bit more about Minder's background, this crime spree, and what happened after he got out of being in jail for 15 years.
Well, he started committing his crimes in the 1950s, from what we can tell. He's been in prison approximately 15 years. It might be give or take a couple of years there, certainly at least 13 years. He was released in 69. At that point, he started picking up his education again from the University of Michigan. Eventually, he earned a master's degree in social work in 1974. He went on to work for a couple of agencies that dealt with youth, and then started a nonprofit agency called Spectrum Human Services, I believe, and that went on to be a very successful endeavor.
Tell us how Minder got involved with Smith & Wesson to begin.
Well, he and his wife retired to Scottsdale, Arizona in 97, and he started a one-man consulting firm out here. But he also became friends with a gentleman by the name of Mitchell Saltz, who founded a company called Safety Hammer. They did child safety locks for guns. Well, that company ended up buying Smith & Wesson Holding Corporation. And hence, when you after that acquisition, then as a board member from Safety Hammer, he then became a board member of Smith & Wesson.
I mean, he had reformed himself. In fact, when he first tried to resign last week, the board rejected the resignation, right?
That's what he told me in an interview at his home. But, of course, I don't believe he was able to contact every board member in the short amount of time from when I contacted him and confronted him with this information to the time I interviewed him. So I suspect he contacted a few of the board members who said they supported him. Since then, they probably have had more time to reflect on this.
I'm wondering, Jonathan, just to finish up, whether anyone in Arizona feels maybe he deserves some credit for having gone wrong in his youth and then reformed himself and done work for youth over the years?
Oh, I believe there is a sentiment that he has paid his dues to society, but there are some troubling aspects, though. In the clips that we received from the Detroit News, he had been investigated, his agency had been investigated in that state for a couple of things that raised some red flags. One of them is that he didn't disclose his felonious past in a couple of licensing applications there in Michigan in the late 70s. Then there was another incident with a group house that he helped found and run, in which they were charging mentally challenged teenagers for work that they didn't do, and yet they were holding on to the money. It gets a little complicated, but there were some issues that popped up with his nonprofit agency in Michigan.
Quite a story. Jonathan Higuera is a reporter for the Arizona Republic. Jonathan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
After months of anticipation and controversy, Mel Gibson's biblical epic, The Passion of the Christ, had a blockbuster opening on Wednesday, We asked moviegoers that first night what they thought of the film.
It was good. I mean, it was the way it is, you know. We all basically killed Jesus. It was not, the controversy is all made up so people won't come see it.
I'm not sure yet, actually. I'm still thinking about it. I think it'll take me about a day to figure that one out.
I loved it. It was life-changing. It's the truth, and I hope everybody that sees the movie has a spiritual change in their life.
It was good. It was really
well done. It was very powerful.
Very well done.
I think it was very accurate, a very good depiction of what really happened to Jesus in his final hours.
But is it? And history and faith aside, is it a good evening at the movies? Well, joining us in the studio is Here Now film reviewer Renee Graham. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Robin.
And we're also joined by Michael Zank, Associate Professor of Religion at Boston University. Welcome.
Thank you.
And finally, two people who have actually seen the movie, both of you. You just heard from one moviegoer who said that it was historically accurate, and yet we've been reading about all the inaccuracies in the film. So your very first thoughts about the film.
Well, it follows its script and its sources very closely. And if it's not historically accurate, it's not because of Mel Gibson following the Gospels, but because the Gospels themselves are not historical document in the strict sense of the word.
Tell us a little bit about that. They were not written, of course, at the time.
No, they were written about 40, 50, 60 years after the death of Jesus, and they reflect very much the circumstances of the time when the early Christian community set itself off from the Jewish mainstream at a time when the Jews waged a very, very difficult war against the Roman Empire, and the Gospels go a long way to try to exculpate the Romans and to shift the burden of guilt entirely onto the Jews.
When, in fact, what was happening in the time of Christ's death was that the Romans were occupying that land, and it was a brutal occupation.
And I think the film actually brings out the brutality of the occupation in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Renee, as you were watching it, tell me some of your feelings.
I think my first feeling was, you know, the first 15 minutes, the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus is having his doubts, there's this Satan figure that's there, the Roman guards come. It's involving at that point. But once the film shifts to his arrest, and from the moment he's arrested, the film becomes just relentlessly brutal. And what was strange about that is watching that is I found myself completely unmoved by it.
Right. I had the same impression.
The problem is that Gibson goes for violent spectacle as opposed to spirituality. This, for a film that's about the last 12 hours of Jesus and the sacrifice he's making, there's not a lot of spirituality here. And part of that is because, and to put it in sort of movie terms, there's not enough backstory. You sort of drop into the Garden of Gethsemane, and from then on, it's, you know, the march up to Calvary, and we all know the end, but we don't know the beginning. We don't know Jesus as a prophet. We don't know him as a teacher. All we see is Jesus as bloody pulp.
Mm. I want to mention one of the characters that you mentioned, the Satan figure, played by Rosalinda Celentano. She's really sort of a frightening creature. Let's listen a little.
Leithai. Anastikai. Lekaima.
Criticism I've heard, Renee, is that this figure is placed among the Jews.
That's later in the film when Jesus is at is before Pilate, and there's a assemblage of the Jewish high priests, and the Satan figure is sort of moving behind them. You know, I do believe that there are people who might find, you know, that aspect of it anti-Semitic. I think there are people who might find the portrayal of Caiaphas, the high priest, anti-Semitic. I didn't find it anti-Semitic, but, you know, I don't know that at this point the anti-Semitism is what people are most talking about in terms of this film.
It's what?
The violence.
The violence.
I mean, there's a flogging scene, you know, somewhat early in the film after Jesus' arrest that goes on for 15 minutes, and it's blood and it's flesh flying, and, you know, I think it's wonderful. You know, Mel Gibson has said he wanted to shock people, but I think a film like this deserves more than just be Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street. It's stomach-churning, but it's not emotionally involving.
What does the Bible say about the scourging?
Well, it mentions it, and it's made all the more poignant by not going into any kind of gory detail. I think that's generally true of the aesthetics of biblical literature.
There's no indication in the Bible that he was, you know, beaten almost to death before he was crucified, and that's the way it comes across in the film.
You mentioned that you didn't see it as anti-Semitic. Some who have seen it question why it wasn't pointed out more that Jesus was a Jew and that something like 250,000 Jews were crucified by Pontius Pilate.
It's certainly true. There were thousands of Jews were crucified every year. Incidentally, the film tries to depict the Jewish community that was occupied by the Romans as a kind of cultural backwater.
The filthy outpost.
And I think that's not true, actually. Jerusalem at the time was one of the most beautiful and glorious cities of the ancient world. I think in many ways it kind of plays into all kinds of conventions, filmic, cinematic conventions, that it just... makes it very unappealing.
Well, the Catholic bishops have given their review. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, it's sort of a mixed review. They've said on the one hand they praised the film for showing the depth of Christ's love, but one of the criticisms they raise is of the depiction of Pontius Pilate. They say the overly sympathetic portrayal of him as a vacillating, conflicted, and world-weary backwater bureaucrat doesn't mesh with the Pilate of history, who killed hundreds of Jewish rabble-rousers without hesitation.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the Pilate of history is not in the New Testament. The New Testament Pilate is already whitewashed of all of these trappings. You have to read other historical sources, such as Josephus, who describes the Jewish war and the time leading up to it, and Roman sources about the various proconsuls and procurators who were occupying or governing Syria and Palestine at the time. And then you realize what kind of a ruthless guy this was.
Hmm. But you walk out of this film feeling like, poor Pontius Pilate.
That's right.
You know, he's got Caesar on his back. He's got these Jewish high priests. He's got the wife with the visions and the hallucinations. What's a guy to do?
And what about the Jews, Professor?
Well, there is an interesting line in the film that you will hear only if you know Aramaic, because it is the most controversial line of the entire Gospels, namely the curse that the assembled Jews bring upon themselves by saying, "May his blood be upon us and our children." Now, if you know Aramaic, you will hear that the high priests actually say this line, but Mel Gibson decided to leave out the subtitles at that point.
And what do you make of that?
Well, he was clearly apprehensive about the possible implication of having this on the screen and subtitled and for everybody very strongly visible. And he was wise to leave it out. He gets to have it both ways. That is, the cognoscenti know it's in there, but the general population doesn't notice.
And it runs directly against the edict from Pope John the 23rd, who wrote a prayer of atonement for causing Jewish suffering. He ends this beautiful paragraph with the lines, "Forgive us the curse which we unjustly laid on the name of the Jews. Forgive us that with our curse we crucified thee a second time." Of course, Mel Gibson has said he's part of a conservative branch of Catholicism that rejects much of that Pope's reforms and teaching.
No, he doesn't follow this teaching.
Are people going to go to this film regardless of what the critics say? Or is there going to be a passion for the passion?
Absolutely. All the controversies, you know, reviews have been wildly mixed on this film. I mean, some people didn't like the film at all, like David Denby from The New Yorker. I don't think it matters. I think this is one of those critic-proof films. The people who support this film are going to go no matter what.
Would you tell film lovers, forget their faith, to go see it?
No.
Professor, would you tell faith lovers to go see it?
We should show the movie and have a theological discussion about it. And I think that's what it's what it could actually do. It could actually help people to see all kinds of aspects about the Christian tradition that are really worth discussing.
Even if it's pointing out the inaccuracies.
Yeah, exactly.
And then hopefully they can go out and rent better films about the life of Jesus.
Such as?
Franco Zeffirelli in 1977 did a six-hour miniseries called Jesus of Nazareth. And as much as Mel Gibson says the Holy Spirit was channeling through him in this film, I think the Holy Spirit was bringing him a few DVDs, too, because there are some scenes in The Passion of the Christ that are very similar to scenes from Franco Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth.
I want to thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
Helping people make their film choices this weekend. Here in Now Film Reviewer, Renee Graham and Michael Zank, Associate Professor of Religion at Boston University.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill.